This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now, my partner in crime for Media Matters, Marty Gibson. Good morning, Marty. How are you?
I'm really good, thanks, Marie. Well, I'm a bit sick, but yeah. I'm pretty good apart from that. Thanks, kids.
You and me both on that score. Actually, I was just looking at the time. It's the afternoon. Anyway, time's getting away on us. So speaking of time getting away on us, have you finished your column yet?
No. I'm going to start writing columns again. I think the key, and I mentioned this on the Fourth Estate last week, the key is just to make them shorter, just to have that discipline. You know, editorial is about 350 words, a column's 600, I think. You know, maybe even 350 words might be a good discipline just to punch them out.
Yeah, get you back into that saddle again.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certain enduring quality to writing that there's not to the spoken word, even though the spoken word is more compelling in many ways. Also, because as you know, I have a lot of theories and I should have a line in the sand to say I came up with them first.
Exactly. Now, there's a lot to discuss this morning, but one of the things, you brought up Fourth Estate. I'm most pleased that you're going to be hosting that now on a consistent, regular basis. Yippee! It's my favourite dog walking listen, I have to say, on the weekend. And there was something that you said, I think it was to Peter, that really stood out to me. And it was
retired Judge David Harvey.
Yep. So it really stood out. And it said, are we having a culture war to prevent us having a class war?
Yeah, he balked at that a little bit because it is something that he thought cloth-capped socialists would say. I think there's some truth in it because we've got to relieve ourselves of the traditional ideas of what constitutes different classes. It's not the people that Steve Brenes is breathlessly covering, the ophthalmologist who's accused of murdering his wife, and it's not even the people in the Herald on Sunday's review of The Big Spend, which is talking about how there are some very, very wealthy people in New Zealand. It's quite funny, after all the talk about how bad our maths education is, in the third paragraph in, it says, allocation for supercars, some worth $1 million a piece, are snapped up in pre-sales as soon as they're released. And this year, a Kiwi couple booked a world cruise that will cost them nearly $500 million. $500 million. I think you mean 500,000. The difference between 1,000 and 1,000,000 is 1,000,000 is 1,000,000. It's Jane Farr. So, but yeah, no, it's not that. It's the people who you don't even read about because they own the stuff you read it in or see it in. And so, yeah, I think to that extent, those people are getting us fighting among ourselves to prevent us looking at how their wealth, say, doubled using debt that we now have to pay back, which they've printed anyway. Things like that.
Yeah, definitely things like that. And it's when you actually also, and I have come across this, those who are in the Wellington public service chattering classes, and they have the self-perception of being working class.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, hun, no. Yeah. No.
No.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
There's that stat that blew me away, which was if you look at the graph of the prevalence of the words racism and trans, it just takes off like a rocket. Around 2012, where the left is starting to talk about Occupy Wall Street and the right are talking about the Tea Party, suddenly racism's a big issue. Mm-hmm. Suddenly men who dress up like ladies wanting to use women's toilets, big issue. And there's only so much outrage to go around, so I think we've got to choose carefully what we give our attention to.
Speaking of outrage, some of the biggest outrage over the last week or so, funnily enough, still comes back to freedom of speech and freedom of expression and what constitutes advertising and what does not. And it, of course, has been that Hobson's Pledge advertisement that was run in NZME. And then all of a sudden, after a bit of pressure is applied is no longer running NZ Made, which I have to admit would have taken a lot for them because, you know, they generally do not turn down a dollar. That's the crew from NZ Made. Really? Really? I mean, yeah. This entire thing, I mean, you've talked about the sacred anger before. And as this continues to heat up with the whole, the Waitangi Tribunal report and stepping outside of the lines and all of these things, the more and more I think, look at this, and I think, man, Marty's on the money, man. This is nothing but a sacred anger, a contrived sacred anger.
I mean, there's a recurrent theme to the way ethno-nationalist Māori are playing the game. There's a repetitive sameness to it. They operate in secrecy, as they did signing the UNDRIP and releasing He Puapua, which no one knew about for 18 months and only came out because of an Official Information Act request that planned to rebuild New Zealand as the ethno-nationalist state Aotearoa. They meet any questions or objections to their agenda with that sacred anger that you mention and counter-accusations of what they're doing themselves, divisiveness and racism. And this stimulates a fawning response, which is I've got a column pretty much finished on because I think it's so key to it. So there's this fawning response among cowardly journalists, politicians, and the weak, stupid, more government, less freedom socialists who enabled the government overreach over COVID, you know, with all their four legs, good, two legs, bad, bleating. Now, while these Māori ethno-nationalists say we need to discuss Te Tiriti, what they really mean is New Zealand needs to unquestioningly accept what we say about it or go back to step two, our big intimidating toddler tantrum or teenage door slamming and eye rolling. There was an article in Newsroom on Monday which actually unwittingly revealed the truth. Now, Newsroom, of course, you helped me out with this, received $2.189 million of public interest journalism fund and came in at number sixth in the trough.
Mm-hmm.
Behind Radio New Zealand staff Sunpix, who run Te Ao Māori News, I think, was it?
Sunpix, yeah, Tangata Pacifica.
Tangata Pacifica, mm-hmm. And no doubt others, TVNZ and Discovery. The intro to that article was, the New Zealand Herald and its publisher NZME has hit a nerve, publishing an advertisement from Hobson's Pledge that critics have called misleading, factually incorrect, and racist. I always think of racist as having
Sure Muriel would have had a word or two to say about that.
Yeah. So it prompted, the full page rap urged readers to sign a petition to restore the foreshore and seabed to public ownership. And this in turn prompted a call out from Māori Journalists Association, Kawia Te Rongo, a boycott from Te Pāti Māori, Iwi Radio severing its ties, and an open letter signed by 170 lawyers refuting the ad's claim. And as I've said before, if Māori had made a rule, for every lawyer we make, we're going to make three engineers and five doctors, New Zealand would be a better place.
I would have been accepting more ads quick smart if they were calling a boycott. To me, that was win-win.
Well, but yeah, the funny thing was, so they've scrapped a second ad planned, but was the outcry against the ad justified? Today, the detail speaks to a former editor-in-chief of the Herald and Tumuaki Wahine, vice president of the Māori Law Society, to find out. So at the center of the debate is a claim there are applications from iwi, hapu, and whānau for customary titles of nearly all the New Zealand coast under the Marine and Coastal Area Act. That part is true. So that's interesting to say, well, yeah, the whole coastline is virtually claimed, often by multiple parties, which is something Muriel Newman is so eloquent about. But what's not true is that these would limit public access to beaches. Okay, so it seems kind of weird that they're saying, well, yeah, we're going to claim it all, but you can still go there and we can't talk about it. Or, as I said, it comes down to you've got to accept what we say or wah, wah, wah. Natalie Coates is the Tumuaki Wahine for Te Hunga Rōia Māori o Aotearoa, the Māori Law Society, one of 170 lawyers who penned an open letter laying out why the ad was wrong and racist. Natalie says, I think it's helpful to go through line by line, but also overall it's important to make sure you look at the ad in its whole and how it creates an impression, she says. The front page ad was titled Restore the Foreshore and Seabed to Public Ownership. This is the first falsehood because, as Coates explains, the majority of the foreshore and seabed hasn't historically been publicly owned. It's not owned by anybody currently, except for the areas of foreshore that are currently in mainly non-Māori private ownership, actually. So the idea of restoration is false, she explains. Okay, so we're going to claim it, but no one owns it. That's what we thought when we came here and there was just you Māoris here. Natalie, that's what got us mess.
Well, it's like sort of trying to create a clean slate so you can enter a game of dibs.
Yeah, well, it's essentially an assumptive close. You know, when you in sales, you say, well, when would suit you to get it delivered? It's kind of like, well, we're just going to assume we own it now. What's astonishing about this is that in the thousands of hours of television, the hectares of newspaper coverage of the outrage at a move to define these principles of te tiriti, no mainstream media journalist has had the integrity to pull on the obvious thread and get to the bottom of what these ethno-nationalist Māori have as their endgame. That's what fascinates me. Yeah. No one will do it. Nor what Islamists have as their endgame.
No, but it reminds me of that conversation, and you were part of it many months ago, I think on the political agenda. And remember, I tried to ask Donna Porketty Phillips that, you know, all of these claims have gone through the Waitangi Tribunal. There's the one famous outstander, which is Ngā Pui. If theoretically all of these claims have been settled, bar one, why are we going through all of this again? And she said it out loud, because it wasn't enough.
I mean, I've talked before about why radical Māori and radical Islam seem so mysteriously aligned, you know, with the witless assistance of their spotty, pencil-necked pinko enablers. I told you I was grumpy today. And the reason is they see themselves as rangatiratanga, ruling over the commoners, or tutua among them, and served by the taurekareka, the slaves, you know, is essentially the non-Māori taxpayers, or in the case of Islam, the non-believers, the apostates, who must give up the fruits of their labor without reciprocity. In Islamic terms, that's to pay the jizya. And, in a predominantly Islamic society, they say we'll tolerate other people, but they've got to pay the jizya. And they've got to do it in a degrading way as well, that's embarrassing. They've got to submit to the denigration of their culture and ancestry and never, ever talk back lest they get blasted by that sacred anger, that disproportionate response. Yeah, at the risk of labouring the point, we've got a real problem in that there seems to have been a process to embed that fawning response I mentioned earlier into our politics, media, academia and public service. Mm. And it's at odds with the way the public feel. So there's a pressure build up there.
And also, too, if you speak to people like Lee Taitua, it's also at odds with how a number of Māori feel.
Oh, for sure.
As well.
I'm talking about them as well, yeah.
Yeah, and they are so frustrated by this. And as an example of that, have you seen with the two new Human Rights Commission appointees that, of course, they're not very happy about the chattering classes again and not very happy about this? With one of them, they're claiming Stephen Rainbow is not allowed to be pro-Israel and they're trawling through all of his social media content and calling him also anti-trans, gay man, by the way. And then Melissa Darby, well, she's got Māori ancestry, but she's obviously the wrong sort of Māori. And she's not allowed to be pro-women. So, of course, they're saying, well, you can't have these people are not suitable to be sitting.
Well, if you go over his posts, they're pretty mild.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been lucky enough to, you know, that social media really arrived. I think I was being a journalist, but I was pretty aware of the enduring nature of what you write. So there's not a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, it would obviously offend people like these, but there's nothing I say, if I can help it, that's hateful, even if it's perceived as such. But yeah, I mean, he said the Palestinian thing that got him in trouble is the situation of the Palestinians will be immeasurably worse after October 7th, not only because of the loss of life and destruction in Gaza, but because the two-state solution is dead. Israel cannot afford a client state of Iran intent on its destruction on its borders. And this is what Hamas has shown will happen if a Palestinian state were to be created.
Pretty factual, I would have thought.
I think that's what they call malinformation, isn't it? It's true, but he's mean saying it.
Yeah, well, it's the inconvenient truth, which is what malinformation really is an inconvenient truth. And again, Melissa Darby, I mean, she's a strong Wahine Māori woman, but she's not allowed to be that because you are only allowed to be that if you fall into the sacred anger camp, apparently. And you're not allowed to defend women's rights, because if you defend women's rights, you're instantly anti-trans. So you're caught between a rock and a hard place on that score as well. So there's lots of wah-wahing going on over that. And I really do hope that fawning response that you talk about does not go beyond either wing clipping or dumping these two new appointees, because some people are scared that they don't fit within their political brief.
Well, you know, you've had toddlers.
Yeah, I have.
Sometimes, you know, the easiest way to end a war is to lose it, but sometimes you just got to let them scream it out, you know, and we've really got to learn to do that. I think also we've got to understand the extent to which all of this is informed by Marxism. There's an interview Jordan Peterson did with Dr. Paul Kengor, which was just fantastic. It's called The Devil and Karl Marx. I think he did it maybe a month or two ago. He pointed out in it that Marx loved the line that comes from the devil character Mephistopheles in Goethe's Faust. And that quote, Marx's favorite quote, was, "Everything that exists deserves to perish." And Marx would chant it, "Everything that exists deserves to perish. Everything that exists deserves to perish." This is who's informing virtually all of our academia. What do you call it? Academy. So it's a philosophy that's about tearing down. This is quoting from his book, "Burning the foundation, leveling the house," to where you have Marx standing there in the smoldering embers saying, "Now we are ready to begin." Does that sound a bit like Te Pāti Māori?
Just a touch.
Anyone that thinks that this is a philosophy that is just about helping one another or sharing wealth or redistributing wealth, they do not understand Marx and Marxism, end quote. So, yeah, Te Pāti Māori's response to the proposed debate on those treaty principles has imagery of guns and flames. They talk about hikoi from hell, right? He puapua means a break. You know, everywhere I see the broken eggs, comrade, where is glorious omelette?
Well, it is also too the whole, and this is how you identify it from, I mean, this is, the show's called Counterculture for a reason. You need to look at all the politics, any story, anything that's going on now. I look at, is this identity or is this humanity? 9 times out of 10, it'll be identity every time. That is that Marxism 101. It's not about the humanity, it's about the identity and about that towing the line and being part of that, the machine, because you are, I mean, you are.
Well, as always, I zoom out and, you know, I ask, why are these radicals being enabled by that Luciferian Club of Rome, the Committee of 300, you know, the billionaire class that I mentioned earlier, three-letter agency glob who have traditionally colonized, cheated, and murdered Islamists and indigenous people? Why is criticism of them apparently banned on corporate media, criticism of indigenous people or radical Islamists? It's because now Islamists and indigenous ethno-nationalists are being used as agent provocateurs to herd us towards their fourth industrial revolution, brand of, you know, neo-feudalist control and slavery. They're being used to pen us and to strip us of a sense of national identity or belonging. That makes it easier for us to be a client state.
It's also too that imagery, like you brought it up with the Olympics, that breaking down, like it's like this erosion, it's applying this acid to break down the pillars of Western society. And I saw just recently, like the proms, I mean, you couldn't get anything more British and Britishness at the end of the summer season as the proms. What did they have at the proms? They had Sam Smith, who is just the most singularly the most ridiculous person in the culture space and music, who can't even decide. He makes up sexualities because he's bored, I've decided. However, the imagery on that is him in red, demonic. They've done it to a full orchestral score, dark red. And I'm like, this is the freaking proms, people. This should be Union Jacks, Rule Britannia. I just was like, wow, Britain has fallen.
Yeah. You can read what their system is because they're very open and proud about it. You know, this is the WEF cadre, you know, supplied our previous two prime ministers. And I suspect, you know, with his love of Bill Gates, Luxon's, you know, been to some parties somewhere. And given the nod. So they're at least envisaging joining technologies like artificial intelligence, gene editing, and advanced robotics to blur the lines between physical, digital, and biological worlds. That's their thing. Within that, there is that kind of idea that Satanists always have of supplanting God. And if you think about it, the AI gives them the omniscience. Things like digital currency give them omnipotence. And things that they want to inject into us and our food and spray in the sky gives them omnipresence. And, you know, you can hear Noah Harari Yuval describe most of us who are surplus to requirements in this vision as useless humans. So the stakes are high.
So this is quite a good segue, because every now and then there's a bit of truthing that goes on in the paper, but there's also a bit of truthing that's not quite the whole truth. It's like they're dipping their toes into the truth pond, but they're not really brave enough to take the full dip. And there were two separate stories that were run across the weekend, and it was around New Zealand's plummeting birth rate. Now, you and I have been discussing this pretty much right from the beginning of Media Matters. I mean, this is a topic, a theme that crops up with us a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, population replacement is you're going to have 2.1 children per woman. So Media Matters is at 2.5. We're doing our bit.
Yes, we are. We are doing our bit. The rate now is lowest it's ever been, 1.52. I mean, we're falling off a cliff. In the Sunday Star Times, Nikki McDonald did a piece called What's Behind New Zealand's Baby Bust? And of course, she rolls out, there's no party without punch, that demographic demigod himself, Paul Spoonley, who always has the most wonderful sense of elephant blindness, I call it. He, of course, looked at all these different elements. You know, was it in regards to finance? Was it in regards to situation? You know, what is creating this absolute demographic blip?
Paul Spoonley, basically, yeah, he, as you say, no show without punch. His big thing has been we need to import a diverse range of other people into New Zealand and then stigmatise anyone who complains as a neo-Nazi. That's his shtick, and he's been pushing that. His answer to why we'd suddenly fallen off a cliff was just almost obtuse, wasn't it?
Well, it was, and there was one of the quotes here. In the 12 months to March, the rate plummeted from 1.65 to 1.52, defying predictions of a pandemic baby boom, says Massey University sociologist Professor Paul Spoonley. Post-COVID, we've seen one of the largest drops in our fertility rate that we've ever seen in a single year. Spoonley cites four main reasons for the baby bust. The first two are wins for women, better education, better jobs. That means having families later, which reduces the available years to have kids and increases with fertility issues. In 2023, most mums were in their 30s and more kids were born to women aged 40 and over than those under 20. And
you just repeat that. Repeat that. That is the...
You and I have discussed this.
Over a thousand more children born to women over 40 than women in their 20s in New Zealand.
Except in Gisborne, though, because I see Gisborne's actually leading the rates on the graph. Shocker, having both been raised there. With the soaring housing and living costs with the past 5 to 10 years, affordability, increasing figures and decisions around family size, says Spoonley, no one dareth speak of its name. No one will talk about, in the using Kiwi Farm parlance, the drenching campaign. Now, I know several midwives. If you were to talk to any midwife, I've spoken to obstetricians, and you discuss anything around fertility at that time and the rates, he conveniently, well, he just couches it as fertility issues. Yeah.
It stays in the arm.
Having been someone who's had fertility issues, there's fertility issues and then there's fertility issues. When you're seeing women who should have no reason to have fertility issues suddenly having fertility issues, when you've got a miscarriage rate, well, had been much higher. I haven't seen figures recently, but it certainly was very high through 2021. That will create issues. But one of the biggest things that I found reading this article and the second one, which was from Un Momento, por favor, was it on that one?
Well, while you're doing that, Paul Spoonley's, this is his shtick summed up. Given the world is arguably overpopulated, is a baby bust really a bad thing? It wouldn't be such an issue if we didn't have a bulge of aging baby boomers, Spoonley says. Fewer kids means fewer future workers and taxpayers at a time when we'll need more of both to provide and pay for ballooning healthcare and superannuation needs. So we need to change New Zealand's demographics to look after the boomers.
But yeah, because the tax farm is dying.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's essentially the tax farm.
The boomers who have basically cheered on their business nows while the Reserve Bank has sprayed, printed money into the economy, and they've been patting themselves on the back saying, hey, you know, I made $200,000 on my house. Oh, okay, push it down, Marty, push it down.
Sorry, and the other article was in the Post, so you may not have seen it. It was called No Kidding, Capital in a Baby Drought. I'm going to read you something from this. This is very Wellington-centric, obviously, because it's the Post.
I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you read it.
I know. I don't know how I do it either. But anyway, in Wellington, the trend is even more pronounced. This is talking about the record. They discuss the record low 1.52. In Wellington, the trend is even more pronounced. In 2023, the number of live births in the capital fell by nearly 10% from 5,610 the year before to 5,196. This was 15,000 fewer pepe, babies, than were born 15 years earlier in 2008. In fact, there were fewer babies, so then they used babies in the following sentence. God, that rips my nighty, Marty. If you're going to use a term, use it consistently. Don't use one term in one sentence and one term in another. Okay, rant over.
Russian outrage. There's only so much to go around.
In fact, there were fewer babies born in Wellington City last year than in either Hamilton or Tauranga, and that's despite Wellington having both higher total population and a higher proportion of women in their 20s and 30s, and also, dare I say it, probably higher salaries as well, because it is the epicentre of the public service. They then went into a demographic breakdown of where these babies were and weren't being born. This is what I found interesting. When the 2023 data was broken down into suburbs of 5 to 10,000 people, it showed that people living in areas where the house prices were the highest were less likely to have babies. Just 6 infants were born in situ, where the house price could set you back 1.7 million, compared to 180 in Tawa, where the average property cost is half as much. So this is the interesting thing. More babies are being born in areas that are demographically lower socioeconomic. So in other words, you're out-successing yourself for having a baby. And one of the things that having gone through what I've gone through to have kids, I know going through what you and your wife went through to have your three beautiful children, the one thing with parenthood is sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And what I'm seeing are a lot of millennials that have gotten very comfortable with their millennial life, that don't actually understand the principle of sacrifice. I know I'm really crabby today.
You old curmudgeon.
I am an old curmudgeon.
Certainly if you're used to swiping right when you get bored, it's going to be tough to have kids because, you know, you've got to – I mean, if I've got three kids, asking each of them 5 times to brush their teeth every day, it does get repetitive, as I explained to them. And then, fortunately, it's down to once or twice now. So it's not so bad. You get through it, but it's been a long 5 to 8 years.
And it is a long 5 to 8 years because, I mean, your kids are – yours
well,
are
13 bit, years, really, because of
– yeah, yeah, exactly. And yours are, you know, a wee bit younger than mine, so I'm sort of a bit further down the track. I have to admit I'm really loving the boys right now. Like, I just I'm seeing these young men just blossom in front of my eyes, and they're these really little independent, well, not little actually, I mean the youngest one's 6'4", but these massive, these incredible independent souls. And so for me, I'm getting lots of Mama Bear feels right now. I'm just totally
digging it. And it does get better and better, and there is that thing of one guy said in the Sunday Star Times article, obviously, as an only child himself, he doesn't think his generation should have more babies to fund the boomer blip. Obviously, it's important that people are looked after, but people are the primary reason why the planet is going all wonky, and I don't really want to contribute to that. I've had a few people say that to me, and I always say, are you planning on having kids that make things better or worse? And they always say better, and I always say, well, you better get on with it then.
Yeah. I love this quote. This is again Sunday Star Times, Danny Duncan. For Duncan, turning 30 made her wonder whether she'd have children. Instead, she decided her job, relationships and independence were enough. My life feels full and wonderful as it is, and to have children would mean a lot of changes and sacrifices, and I simply do not want to do it. And then there were others that they spoke to that only had a single child, and one actually discussed, and they had a bit, actually it was in the Post article talking about their very small child and how they wanted to all their experiences with their child and take them away on holidays and do all of these things, and they didn't want to have to sacrifice not to give their child these experiences. And I just feel like saying, I want to say the word I'm not allowed to say,
we should
really badly right now, sake, for the sake, grow up.
All of these kids have been through an education system that is informed by various French pedophiles and perverts and, you know, the Luciferian Karl Marx. You know, they've been through an education system that's basically informed by a guy whose favorite saying was, everything that exists deserves to perish. So in order to have kids, you've got to have a reverence for life. Certainly my attitude to abortion, I've refused to get into arguments about it, but I will say I've seen three children born, and if I think about how they are now, they were all right there in that instant, and they're very different. We are denying life's will in doing that, and rather than argue about abortion, I'm far more interested in arguing 9 months. Zoom out. You know, why are women, you know, not using abundantly available contraception and having unprotected sex with men they know will make terrible fathers and aren't in committed relationships to? You don't want to dictate to everyone, but maybe we could substitute a bit of the teaching of 13-year-olds about anal sex with, you know, maybe teach a few of them about how to be married. Do the transition early if they suggest that they want to do that.
Which is why one of the families that did highlight in that article was a family who was a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. Both parents worked. They had, you know, good professional jobs, and they had a very large family. I think it was five or six kids. Six kids, I think it was. And they made it work. And I tell you what, they would be in that family, they wouldn't be worrying about those overseas holidays. They're probably not worried about every single one of them having the latest smartphone or device. They probably don't have every streaming service known to man. Are they actually buying plane packets or house brands at Pack and Save each week? Yeah, probably. But you know what? If you're raising that family and you cherish those children, those sacrifices are the easiest things in the world to make. But this is just it. You've gone and raised. There is a whole generation of adults out there who've been raised in this instant satisfaction, this instant comfort, and they're not prepared to give any of it up. Just look at them all the way back in 2021 when told that actually you won't be able to go to the hairdressers or the movie doll, and they, no, two shots for summer. Oh, and they rolled up their sleeves. Why did they roll them up? They didn't even look into it. They rolled it up so they didn't have to disrupt their comfortable little lives.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of factors that Spoonley doesn't really go into. I mean, the other one, obvious one, is there's a lot of hypergamy, which is mating up. And so there are a lot of girls who've maybe had contact with men who do have it together and are financially secure but wouldn't necessarily marry them. And so settling for a man that's kind of on their pegging feels like a crashing disappointment.
Save me from my malady, Marty. Have you got anything to save me from my malady? I didn't quite realise I was going to get quite grumpy this grumpy today.
Well, I was suspicious that it would, and so I thought I did lay out a bit of a positive take of what we might do instead of Karl Marx's burn everything to the ground and class war and
hallelujah.
So
hit me with that.
So here's my positive take on specifically around the Treaty Principles Bill and the COSO, all that sort of stuff. We acknowledge the positive more than the sum of our parts aspects of race relations in New Zealand. So, you know, we celebrate some of our great history and capacity to achieve things together. We identify our common interests. and common, you know, in terms of we all want to live in safe neighborhoods with healthy kids who contribute to the nation. We use those common interests as a gathering point for people of goodwill. So, you know, you're saying there's Māori on, and, you know, you and I in some ways are a meeting of that. You know, you're a pretty Pākehā Māori and I'm a pretty Māori Pākehā. And we get on with working together to make things better and use our achievements to starve radicals on both sides of oxygen. And so that actually doing something is important at this juncture, because these guys will have the revolution that they're craving if we're not careful. And we then use those strengthened relationships as an anchor point for frank and at times uncomfortable discussion as equals, rather than, as I said, a fawning relationship. I saw Chris Hipkin saying, oh, you know, you're not getting togetherness. It's like you're fawning in front of people who would have flushed your head down the toilet at school is not togetherness, Christopher. It's submission. It's paying the jizya. It's degrading. And most Kiwis aren't into that. And we maintain our individual identities under one government, recognising that we can't always get what we want.
Isn't that the key? You can't always get what you want.
I don't get what I want. There's only so much, as I said, so much capacity for outrage as well. So, you know, let's direct it at the loss of potential in children that we've grown to tolerate in New Zealand. That's outrageous. That there are kids in gang families who are maths geniuses who won't get to fulfill their potential.
You know, one of the stories that really leapt out at me over the weekend? Did you see the story about the bodybuilder?
Oh, yeah, I did. I didn't highlight anything, but, I love that sort of thing.
Yeah, Devlin Rogers was his name. He was given he called it a healthy ultimatum from his former partner. So he'd had a girlfriend, they had split. And after she'd split, she found out she was pregnant. And so she gave him an ultimatum, because at that point he said he'd broken up, he was drinking, doing things he shouldn't have been doing, going down the wrong path and looking at patching up with the mob, mongrel mob. And she gave him the ultimatum. She either said, sort yourself out. If you go down that path, you're never going to see this child. Or you don't go down that path, you sort yourself out, and you can actually become a father, be an active father in your child's life, even though they're not together as a couple, which is a really ballsy thing for her to do, I have to say. And boy, did he do it.
Yeah. It's amazing how little encouragement people get and how little it sometimes takes to, not that threatening to cut you off from a child is a little thing, but
no, yeah. But it's also too...
Kids need encouragement, not excuses.
Yeah, and you know what? A lot of these stories I've noticed, which are stories of what I call quiet courage, that have been coming up in the paper, have been written by Joseph Losey. Have you noticed that? I'm thinking, Joseph, I'm going to have to follow you a little bit more, because I've noticed you've plucked out a few stories that are like, yes, Joe, it's almost like a quiet sort of... There is really good essence here. Although, so this is from Rogers. Rogers said it was an easy choice. I wanted to be in my son's life because I don't know who my biological father is. I don't know his name, and I have carried that hurt with me my entire life. I couldn't do that to my son. All the boys I went to school with patched members, and I don't hold that against them. A lot of them were born to be patched members of a gang and never had a chance not to join from the get-go. When I was 15, I got into trouble with the law. It still haunts me, and I don't like thinking about it, as I was falsely accused of a crime I didn't do. I became an angry young fella and ended up remanded in youth justice in Palmerston North. In remand, I changed my behaviour and was allowed home. After 2 days of a court hearing, I was found not guilty. That trauma has travelled with me ever since, and the reason why I have trouble being affectionate or close to people. But that changed when I had my son. Because some wrong had been done to me, doesn't mean he should miss out on the affection from his dad, but I still find having relationships quite hard. And he has, again, sacrificed. He could do bodybuilding. It's hardcore. And he's gone and put that as focus to have that life with his son. And I think, wow, if you want to know where the joys of parenthood are, the simplicity of the importance of becoming a parent.
And how it calls forth the best characteristic done well, ideally.
Totally.
Sometimes it calls forth the worst in some people, and yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. So you're right. I know with our kids when they were really little, you know, and yeah, I mean, you remember them, you know, especially that toddler early primary hood stage where it's all about me. It's all about me. It's all about me. It's, I want, it's all about me. I used to have on my phone Mick Jagger, "You can't always get what you want." And I used to just play it to them.
Well, you know, with our youngest especially, I find often I'll sigh and just have that George Orwell quote run through my head that I mentioned earlier. Sometimes the quickest way to end a war is to lose it.
Yes, yes. We had the most fantastic, because I think I've mentioned before, our oldest is neurodiverse, and so you can imagine the battles we went through in the day. And the best advice, some of the best advice I ever got from the most incredible child psychologist that really did change our lives, is he has said to us, sometimes you need to lose a battle to win a war, and you've got to pick your battles. And it is so true. So true. Hey, now we got quite a bit of feedback. It's got some really cool feedback, actually.
Oh, nice.
This is going to, I think it's going to put us in a better mood.
Oh, good. I'm sorry, dear listeners. We're sorry for being grumpy.
Okay, the first one, Marie and Marty for Prime Minister, cheers Annie.
I don't know about that.
I know. No Annie, but we like to have our mythical Marty party, Marty and Marie party, and that's where we like to be, in this unicorn space. But thank you that you think that that is the case. Actually, in regards to the conversation that I had with Peter Williams, did you hear that last week? We didn't.
I have heard a couple with him. Maybe I didn't, Marie.
No. Pete, it's been so good to see
you. I've been listening to people that you were De Boer.
Oh, yeah, Diwa does some great stuff. Yeah. So Peter, it's saying from Candace, Peter, I cannot believe what I'm hearing from you regards Caster Semenya. It's disappointing to hear how misinformed you are, and I do appreciate your usually otherwise informative perspectives. Semenya is a DSD male with XY chromosomes and has fathered his own children through IVF as he produces sperm through internal testes. I've just listened to your comment regarding to how you feel that Semenya is a fantastic athlete, and it's a shame she was barred from competing in a female category. A female cannot father children. If you aware, it's the first, second and third in the women's 800 metres at 2016 Olympics were all DSD XY athletes. Not a single woman stood on the podium. What he did talk about too, which was fascinating, and I'm really glad you brought up in terms of who was on the podium, he also talked about other examples throughout the Olympics. So it's, we've got an awareness of it now, but it's actually been an issue in the Olympics for years. Mike, our lovely Mike. Hi, oh, Mike. I'm listening to you and Marty and I've worked it out. It's all your fault. Oh, dear, Mike, what have we done? You two should be running the country, making the decisions. In unicorn land, Mike, we like to live in the grandstand of the insides of our own ideals. Marie and Marty as Prime Minister and Deputy, and then we could have some common sense running the place. I'm sure you would bring back a Ministry of Works, a rail system that works, rail ferries that actually sail, and a judiciary system that puts actual criminals in jail, an education system that recognises excellence instead of equity and equality, and I'm sure that you would get rid of Māori seats, but most importantly, an energy sector that works for the country with diesel, hydro, gas, and God forbid, nuclear power. These are just a few things that could help the country into the future, but that's just my opinion. So you two, the fault is yours and you need to be in power running the country. Look, I fixed the problem, so please get started before the loonies completely ruin everything. Mike from Foxton. Well, Mike, I think you've just put your hand up for the job. Pip, there you go. Just saying. So thank you, Mike. Marie, hey, thanks for your answer to my critique of Aotearoa mention. It's not the name of our country and probably never will be. Regarding to the conversation with Peter Williams about Harris's running mate, he is not middle of the road. He's not a vet. In fact, he resigned rather than be deployed to combat, inflated his own credentials and is a proponent of the Red Bird. Ben Shapiro on the Daily Wire has an excellent review of this dangerous man. Cheers, Alan. Yes, Alan. And actually, to be fair, I pre-recorded with Peter, and when I pre-recorded with him was before all of this had come out. And you are quite right. Right, let's keep going. Charmaine said, it's a pity that the Paris Olympics will be remembered for the wrong things. However, did you read Bruce Cottrell? Bruce Cottrell's piece for me, Marty, this week just reminded me that what I should do is actually go back and watch some of the replay moments, because he then highlighted some of the athletes that we had, the sacrifices they made to embolden and bring the Olympic spirit back. And I think sometimes you've got to move past your big old bad selves about things that upset you. From David, hi Marie, I love your and Marty's conversations. Well, actually, most of your conversations with your guests are fabulous and bloody interesting. Thank you, David. Anyway, I would like to pass this on to Marty, as I think he may find it enlightening. And I came to the same conclusion last year. And you got that link, I think?
Yeah. I mean, there was a pretty detailed chat about the history of that conflict dating back to the Crimean War on the political panel last week. So if you're interested, David, have a listen to that. That came out before I saw your letter. And yeah, there were some similarities in the two.
Excellent. And then, as I mentioned right at the very beginning, Marty is now doing the Fourth Estate on a regular basis on Fridays. That's at noon on Fridays. The one that he did last week with retired Judge Harvey and
Rob McCullough.
Oh, was it Rob? No, that's right. Yep. Sorry, tell a lie. Yep. Last week.
Great men. So good. And this week, I think we've got Peter Williams and Rachel Stewart, which is always a joy.
That's such a good combination. Yeah, and we talked about this, was it in the Foundation members call that we were in on Sunday, because Rob was lamenting how in media they were continually going back and back and back to the same commentators all the time, you know, the ANZ chief economist or the ASB chief economist.
Yeah, and I was moaning about Liam Dan and his obsession with
So there were two laugh out loud moments just before we go today, two laugh out loud moments which tie in for both of these, both Liam Dan's piece and Heather Duplessis-Allen. And first up, Liam Dan. So you were bemoaning how
did he just write the same column over and over and over again?
Well, I mean, he's a broken down record. I mean, he's like a parrot that just keeps going, monetary theory is working, monetary theory is working, monetary theory is working. And what did he say in his column this week, Marty?
There will be time enough for serious academic economists to sift through the wreckage of the past 5 years and come to conclusions about the decisions and what we learn for next time. For now, I'll take two lessons to heart. Number one, monetary policy still works. And number two, people really hate inflation.
Monetary theory is working. Monetary theory is working. Monetary theory is working.
And Rob was very interested in that. He said, you know, the journalists want to be invited to this stuff. They want to be a member of the club. So, you know, they'll cozy up to the Reserve Bank governor so they can say, well, I was talking to the Reserve Bank governor. Yeah. They don't really know what they're talking about.
And then I flicked you a text saying, after I read Heather on Sunday, and I'm like, wouldn't it just be wonderful to know that she, I know she'd probably written this by Friday, but wouldn't it be wonderful to know that she had actually listened to you and Rob and David, because Nick Minnett, final paragraph, quoted in her column, Professor Rob McCullough.
Yeah, if we can get him a wider audience, it will be a good thing. And same with David, and same with Rachel, and same with Peter. I'm not arguing that the more government, less freedom people shouldn't have any presence in the media. I'm not arguing that people of my own beliefs should be 80% of journalists, but I'm just saying when 80% have the opposite view, there's a lack of balance, in the same way as there's a lack of balance in discussing things like the treaty principles. Because these media companies that have taken the 30 pieces of silver from Comrade Cindy are duty-bound even now to report on things in a certain way, and that is like having a jammed rudder on a boat.
Indeed it is. So, of course, you will find Marty doing the Fourth Estate on Fridays from midday. And you can go back and listen to the replays. Here's the best thing. It's the one thing I do love about the app. You can go back and listen to any of the replays that you want to listen to. Just download the app, Android, iPhone, doesn't matter. Or you can do it on your desktop, just realitycheck.radio. We'll bring that up and listen to all of those replays at your own leisure. So,
and thanks so much to all the Foundation Club members who, as you say, we spoke to on Sunday, who make it worthwhile. If you haven't joined up yet, we're getting more and more inventive about how we can return value for that while still providing the free content to everyone. So we're at the stage now where if you go back to those replays, it is kind of a random thing, isn't it? You almost can't listen to everything, although there was a guy Rodney was talking to who's got a lawnmower business who claims to have listened to every single program we've made, but there's a growing volume there that's hard to deal with. But yeah, such good content. Incredible.
It's, I mean, I struggle
to get through. We do say so ourselves.
Yeah, no, there is some great stuff there. So thank you to everybody who has tuned in today. We really do enjoy your time. And if you've got anything that you want to let Marty and I know, 2057 is the text number and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email, and we will do it all again next week. Thank you for your time this afternoon, Marty.
Thank you so much, Marie. And yeah, have a great week, everyone.
Take care.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.